Good morning, everyone. My name is Kathleen Newland, and I'm very pleased to welcome you to the Migration Policy Institute this morning, those of you who are with us physically and those of you who are joining us on live stream. I'm very, very pleased to be presiding over the launch of a new book that MPI is releasing today. It is called How Can Talent Abroad Induce Development at Home? And the editor of this book, Yevgeny Kuznetsov, is with us. Yevgeny is a senior research fellow at the Migration Policy Institute. He's also deputy director of the Center for Research Policy at the Skolkovo Institute of Science and Technology in Moscow, which is affiliated with the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And before that, when I first knew Yevgeny, he was one of the big brains at the World Bank, who very much pioneered the study of diasporas and their role in development. We're also joined, and I'm very happy to welcome Lev Frankman. He's a development economist and is affiliated with the Higher School of Economics in Moscow. He, too, is a veteran of the World Bank, and he and Yevgeny have shared an interest in this topic for some time. And we're really happy to welcome both of them. Lev is a contributor to the volume. Their fuller bios are on your chairs and online, so you can learn more about their extremely fascinating backgrounds. We are going to start with an introduction to the book by Yevgeny, and I just want to express personally my appreciation of this volume. It, as you know, has become really one of the pillars of the whole international migration and development discussion. And so there's a lot of activity, a lot of research, a lot of sort of policy discussions around diaspora engagement. I think Yevgeny and the extremely sort of talented group of thinkers he's in this book are taking a slightly different cut at the whole topic of diaspora engagement and the kinds of contributions that diasporas make to development in their countries of origin or ancestry. And I think it's a really important and extremely significant take from the point of view of policymakers, which goes beyond some of the usual approaches that are just, you know, sort of gathering the diasporas, communicating with them, but perhaps not with as quite as targeted a program or a policy approach as Yevgeny and his colleagues lay out. So I would like to thank both Lev and Yevgeny for being here. We'd like to thank the MacArthur Foundation, which supported the production of this book and has been a great supporter of MPI's work on diasporas generally. So without further ado, Yevgeny, let me turn this over to you, and we look forward to your remarks.
Thanks, Kathleen, for a very nice introduction, and to MPI for being home when finalizing the book. And I think first thing to know about me and Lev, that we are part of the World Bank diaspora, which means that we are not researchers in any traditional sense. We want solutions, and we want solutions to development problems. And I think my attempt today would be try to outline how we see the role of diaspora in this quest and search a solution. And this is a different take to which Kathleen alluded. So again, thanks to MacArthur Foundation, who actually initiated this project. And the book, which you see, is actually one part of it. The second part is a series, a portfolio of World Bank project in which we try to pilot and mainstream the diaspora agenda we propose. So as usual, the presentation is perhaps overloaded, and I may skip some slides. But what I would like to get to give a sense of, or rather a gist of, is our motivation for doing this work. Some glance at the analytical framework, some words about finding, and finally policy implications, because that's at least is what is most interesting for us. So motivation can be illustrated with the following example, which comes from Ireland, and it is about Good Friday Agreement and how Padraig O'Malley, who is a member of Irish diaspora and a professor at the and University of Massachusetts, had actually engineered a study of two warring factions of in the Irish conflict, a week-long study tour to South Africa to talk with Nelson Mandela. And it was a tremendously difficult enterprise, first of all, logistically, because the two warring factions wouldn't even come to each other within a 1.5 kilometer. So everything has to be set up to take into account this million of idiosyncrasies which were involved. But in the end, after 1 year talks where Nelson Mandela was really a critical intermediator, they started to talk to each other, which didn't happen before. And I'm skipping a lot of intermediate steps, obviously, and I am tremendously oversimplifying. But everyone agrees now that that study tour was a very important contributing factor to the Good Friday Agreement. And that Padraig O'Malley was, in our terminology, the first mover who not only introduced a new idea, but he also introduced a new approach to building an institution, which is a peace building. And so diaspora first mover, someone who introduces something new to the country, is really the focus of our study and the motivation for it. So the focus, how skills and talent abroad can engage in institutional development at home, meaning creation of institutions of various sorts of educational, innovation, and public sector and other institutions. How to question, how do we do that, is the main focus of the book. And countries where we look, and you can see the study in the book, are very diverse. It's South Korea, Russia, India, Mexico, Argentina, Chile, Morocco. So it's a mix of mostly middle income, but also some low income country. And evidence is decisively mixed. And this is, I guess, another difference to which Kathleen was alluding to. It's not only survey work, but it also in-depth interview, and so basically we collected a lot of stories, which usually don't count for much in economic theory, because they're supposed to be anecdotes and are not taken very seriously. But if these stories and anecdotes are diverse and they seem to transmit the same message, then we can construct what Rick Nelson called appreciative theory, sort of theorizing on the basis of a very diverse set of stories. And that is what we set to do in this project, basically. So parts of the project. As a preview, what we actually have in mind as a policy tool, we want to develop a so-called pragmatic or indirect approach to diaspora engagement, in which diaspora always comes as a second step in the discourse, meaning that the first step is actually what kind of question or what kind of problem and solution you are trying to solve and tackle. And then diaspora members, maybe or maybe not, can be part of this solution. So, and from this perspective, you can see how diaspora members can become a part of the country because they're engaged in everyday practices in this country, without being aware that they are part of the diasporas. A nice anecdote. I am talking with the Minister of Biotechnology in India, and she's telling me how diaspora members are engaged in every step of the project cycle in biotechnology that they're developing. They are looking for projects, they're reviewing them, they're mentors of the project, and then she asks me, what is diaspora? You keep talking about this, but I don't because from her perspective, it's not really important. She's not part of the diaspora discourse, so to speak. She's a doer. She's looking for solutions. And she sees talent abroad as a pragmatic tool to look for these solutions. And she uses them, or rather relies on them, motivates them to get engaged. And this is sort of a gist of this instrumental approach we are trying to develop. So basically, we have three parts in the project. And the first one is diaspora members as contributors to the home country development. And we developed a theory of so-called inside-out reforms. I'm not going to have time to talk about it in detail. It's going to be a kind of seduction for you to look at the book, to put it in this way. Introduction of a theme of mid-skill migration, something intermediate between high-skill migrant workers, which everyone wants. Skilled, which is a totally different debate. So there is a chapter of Natasha Iskander, which I think is an extremely promising one in this book, which basically sets this agenda. I see here people from Mexico. This is one of the take on Mexico. And finally, the third part is policy implications, on which I hope to spend a little bit more time. A little of a theory. What we are looking as a policymakers is a search for solutions. So the theoretical notion that we are introducing, or rather reintroducing, because it was introduced by a person who is implicitly a part of this project, Chuck Sable from Columbia University, is the idea of a search network of individuals or institutions which helps to relax constraints on development. And they usually do this by going abroad. That's what usually happens. For instance, you have a problem with your innovation performance in your firm, or you have a problem in university performance in the public sector. What kind of network you can construct to relax these constraints? So search network would be a first kind of a theoretical step we are building. Diaspora members become a part of this search network. This is a kind of this my second part of the discourse. And here is an example of how such search networks emerge. Examples come from Chile, when a head of Foundation Chile, which is one of premier development organizations in the country, the name of is the head of Foundation Chile meets Ramon Garcia, who is a Chilean biomedicine engineer, which is based in New Jersey. He meets him in airport, and they jointly in Miami. That's how it usually happens. Now, and they jointly develop a joint company which is owned by Foundation Chile and the company which Ramon Garcia owns, because Ramon has the know-how, has the entrepreneurial capability, and has the company, and has the interest to contribute. And the head of Fundación Chile actually have the instruments to and the need. And the need for this knowledge. So they jointly develop a company, which is described here, and then a second company. And they create an industry which is based biotechnology, a series of companies in biotech, which are absolutely crucial for the development of innovation in Chile because they have a series of disease in salmon, and the solution that Juan Garcia has. So here you have it. Here there are two individuals on both sides and two organizations on the both sides, from the Foundation Chile, Ramon Garcia, and head of Foundation Chile, who are trying to find the solution, and they find this this search network, which grows into a cluster, because now Ramon Garcia has six firms already in different areas of biotechnology, which he founds with Foundation Chile. And this is what actually is important to us. So they are, in a way, exceptions from the general rule. This example of mine, both the head of Fundación Chile and Ramón García, that they, because they are more entrepreneurial than the others. You can't really say that they are the rules. Public sector has its problems. It can be inflexible. So not everyone has entrepreneurial drive and capability like Foundation Chile has. So we start with exceptions. And there is a suspicion, a hypothesis actually, that every development starts from exceptions, from good exceptions. And so the question is, how do these exceptions form a critical mass? And how they get institutionalized without getting bureaucratized? Because they can easily get stifled. Again, just to give a gist, this is an example of how early stage venture capital industry got formed on the basis of such exception. This is a familiar example, not new, because it's due to Anna-Lisa Ksenian, but it's important in our argument because it shows how this critical mass can emerge and how much time does it take. It usually takes about a generation. So as the slide shows, the story is quite usual, massive immigration of students to study in the U.S. universities. Many of them stay in U.S. firms in Silicon Valley. And then the exception from the other side, Mr. Lee, minister without portfolio, has a vision that Taiwan needs a venture capital industry and innovation clusters. No one takes it seriously in the government or in the country. That's also important because if no one takes it seriously, you can do things. You will not be stifled by vested interest. So let these people have its sort of child's play. Let them experiment, because it's not going to be important. That's the assumption of the mainstream government and the multinational corporations, because Taiwan at this time, beginning of 80s, was a rapidly growing economy, but the economy dominated by big banks and the economy dominated by multinational corporations. Basically, something similar that you have perhaps in China now. There was no culture of experimentation and like you have it in Silicon Valley. So they establish a couple of venture funds on a pilot basis, and they change the laws to facilitate the emergence of venture capital. Some of the high achievers from Taiwanese diaspora actually have to relocate. That's what seduction again, because there has to be a special motivation for them to get back to Taiwan and make sure that this first two initial venture capital funds. Once they show promise, the established players started to feel that something new, they are emerging, and they can't stay away from the new emerging game. So that's how two funds give rise to another funds, and in a 5 or 10 years, a new venture capital industry has emerged in Taiwan. This is a first mover role. Something which hasn't existed before now becomes a face of a country, so to speak, to such an extent that almost everyone now comes back to Taiwan after education in the U.S., after foreign education in general, so that the government is playing that they are losing the vital link to Silicon Valley. So their antennas are now shut because everyone is coming back. But one thing that it's a good complaint to have, at least for the countries we are talking about. So what was the role of Mr. Lee and his own diaspora network? The metaphor that we use is the Archimedean lever. Something that you can rely on to find the space to navigate within a space of vested interest. Remember that we are dealing with middle-income and low-income countries. So different kind of vested interests, local landlords, subsidy recipients, universities, trade unions, you name it. It's always difficult to introduce new things. Those of you who work in developing countries or work in the government in general, because sort of if you look at the story of migration in the U.S., it's a very, very similar story. You can see how difficult it is to move with reforms because you touch upon established interest, which doesn't allow you to do this. And diaspora become crucial at certain point because they know the country. They know how to navigate this vested interest because perhaps at some point they were part of it. But they are not yet part of this vested interest. It doesn't mean that they can't be. So this first mover argument works both ways, meaning that first mover role is not necessarily providential or good. If you look at, for instance, first long-distance nationalism of diasporas, you can see how diasporas can play a highly negative role in conflict. So every good things in life can become bad things in life. So one has to be aware of that. But this is nonetheless so. So you can be an Archimedean lever for something not particularly productive. But this is one hypothesis we explore in this book. So the first question which arises in the mind of a skeptic, and there may be skeptics in this audience too, do countries need large skilled diasporas to generate Taiwan-type dynamics? In other words, do you need to be Taiwan, India, or China to have these dynamics we are talking about? Because Taiwan stories, sort of Asian stories are well known. And a skeptic might say, did you uncover anything new? And the tentative answer that we are giving that no, relatively small diasporas of skilled individuals can make a lot of difference as well. But the virtuous cycle we are talking about and the first mover role may not necessarily be about the whole economy in general, but can be limited to certain segments of this economy. This is sort of heterogeneity argument that you may not want to transform the whole economy because it's just a task which is too large for you. But certain segments in education, in innovation can be dynamic. And that's where diaspora can be helpful. And an example of such countries is, for instance, is Chile, where Chile Global, of which Ramon Garcia examples. It's interesting how talking about how these countries immediately trigger Spanish language in my head. That's what I started to talk now. So this is the hypothesis. As an example, Russia. A chapter which Lev actually take a lead on. We have a association of diaspora individuals from a regional university, which is in Siberia, Tomsk, a very good university, University of Electronics Technical University, that in the 80s, most of graduates emigrate. They immigrate to Silicon Valley, but they want to contribute. Not to contribute with their funds necessarily, but they become a part of a new incubator they establish. They establish internships, bringing students, and they change curricula of the university. So they participate in a lot of low-key reforms, which were important. And similar examples we have in all countries, in Chile, India, China, you name it, which are low-key in the sense that they do not require a lot of investment or they don't encounter a lot of resistance. But this time, these changes, and this is the idea of inside-out reform, can lead to quite significant transformations. So I am going to have one quiz and then go to policy implications. This is a thing which shows a stock of tertiary educated foreign-born residents in OECD countries. So a proxy in a way for educated diasporas. So we look at four countries in detail in this book: Mexico and Russia with fairly large diasporas, and then Argentina and South Korea with fairly small diasporas. Now the question is, which country you think takes the second place in this table? Remember, it's not only developing countries. You say in this table. So it's developed countries also.
Is it written? My husband is English. That's why. That was a hint.
It is English language and British universities, which are quite good. And so British people are everywhere. So they are our second largest. Which means that so-called brain drain is not just a phenomenon of developing economies. We are talking about a global phenomenon. So I'm going to skip a lot of stuff, but what we are developing, and go to the policies, because that's where heart is. What we are developing is, I guess, a portfolio approach to the diaspora initiative, in which we distinguish between sort of three segment, a low risk and low impact. This is basically remittances agenda, which occupied a limelight for quite a while. Then there is a medium risk, medium impact. This is FDI promotion, skill transfer, innovation, where diaspora members can be instrumental. And then the most interesting and the most difficult is high risk, high impact project, where diaspora are agents of change. And all my examples so far, and I gave three, or rather alluded to three. The first one is the Irish with Padraig Gumali. Second one is with the Chilean one, and the third one is Taiwanese. This is when they can introduce some significant innovation which changed lives of quite significant number of people in a significant way. So in a way, what we are looking at is in reform dynamics, which is in the top of this pyramid, in which all instruments are good and important, remittance, donation, investment, knowledge, and innovation, because that's four channels which are usually looked at the literature, but the question is how they can contribute to this institutional change and reforms. So logics which can be seen in policy discussions about diaspora. The first is direct, or how we call it, administrative, where diaspora is viewed as a special agent that we want to foster link with diasporas because we have because this is a responsibility of a state. And then, for instance, if you're talking about diaspora ministry, that would be an approach. And indirect and or pragmatic, which the book tries to introduce, where ex ante there is no special preference to diaspora is given. It emerges gradually and incrementally as part of the solution. Remember, in all my examples, no one was trying to on purpose to foster link with diaspora. The problem was to develop innovation firms, search for solution to find cure for disease, that Chilean example with biotech, to find the new innovation dynamics in Taiwan, and then diaspora emerges as part of the solution, but not necessarily the main key and single agent in it. So if you are if you sort of this is the kind of tables which the World Bank people like, because it's sort of what it tends to do, and it probably would take me 10 minutes, which I don't have to explain it.
Good point for to start the discussion.
To start the discussion. But what it intends to do is to juxtapose two logics, this indirect vis-a-vis direct approaches, and then bottom-up vis-a-vis top-down, because you can do it in a bottom-up and top-down way. And then you can see that there are four distinct approaches to diaspora engagement, which are actually quite different. So let me hang here, because this is in a way some kind of novelty which are already being taken into action and operation in international development agencies, mainly in the World Bank, which is extremely gratifying for us. Well, hopefully I didn't confuse you too much and gave some food for thought, at least.
You certainly did the projects that flow from it, and indeed have been part of many of the sort of centralized, top-down, direct agenda initiatives, and that gives me a great appreciation for alternatives. Lev, I'd like to give you a chance to talk a bit about your contributions to this work. I know you and Evgeny have worked very closely over the last many years.
I would save my time, probably give more space for general discussion.
Okay.
I didn't plan for any special remarks at this point.
Okay, that's fine. The chapters that Lev has contributed to, well, there are several chapters that Lev has contributed to in the book, and they deal, as Yevgeny mentioned, with Russia, also with Africa, which is where there's a great deal of interest in sort of tapping the diaspora and sort of using the diaspora in this very top-down instrumental approach. And it was heartening to me to see that there are some other things going on in Africa, that there really have been some of these bottom-up problem-solving approaches, which have borne fruit both in the sort of economic space and institutional reform, as well as in peace building. We're ready to open this up for discussion, and I'd love to hear from all of you, and especially those of you who work with diasporas in particular countries. If you don't mind, I'd like to sort of abuse my privilege as the chair and maybe ask the first question, and that is that in the model that you are sort of implicitly endorsing, which is a sort of problem-solving and originating from within the diaspora under their own initiative. People just see a need, have an interest, and start working together. What's the role for government in this? I mean, very often, and I think it's pointed out in the book, if somewhat diplomatically, government can really be a dead hand on diaspora involvement, you know, picking particular favorites among the diaspora who are not necessarily the most innovative. But on the other hand, some governments have really sort of encouraged an innovative approach. So what do you think governments can do to be constructive in this space?
Well, there are two.
Let's take a first crack at this, if you don't mind.
Probably the main risk, as I said, is building government-wide single universal policy and stifling local initiatives which could emerge from individual agencies mm-hmm. and first movers which are hiding all over the government. My favorite example, as usual, coming from Armenia, from 90s, where it's a very top political level, it was this attitude to diaspora, give us your money and go home. Mm-hmm. Please don't intervene, we know better, we don't need anything from you, just your money. And this kind of single policy line, or party line, if you wish, which was to a large extent created a major divide between people in diaspora which were looking for solutions and were interested in bringing not just money but expertise and practical day-to-day help and this government attitude which ultimately not just wanted money but also was concerned about possibilities of political competition from diaspora activists. So what government could do is allow for variations, allow for internal competition of ideas and approaches.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or if they can't do that, at least get out of the way. That's sometimes
of the government. First of all, sectoral government agencies have had to be receptive because it is these sectoral agencies who are looking for solutions. So the government role is central, and I think Ireland would be the best example how they do that. They have a series of enterprise Ireland have a series of networks in biotechnology and in almost everything, which are not diaspora networks again, but they are include diaspora members. And by the way, there is another acronym in this book which is called MARS, because countries which we looked in a fair detail and the survey book is Mexico, Argentina, Russia, and South Korea. MARS or ARMS, sort of these four countries. And the country which came out worst in terms of government involvement turned out to be South Korea. Which is how highly counterintuitive, because South Korea is extremely efficient government in general, but it's very monolithic. It's very Weberian. It sort of it does not necessarily look for solutions which are out of the box, which diaspora can offer you. Argentinian government and even Russian government turned out to be much better in that, because they don't have that amount of resources or capability. They have to be more resourceful and proactive sometimes. So this propensity and interest of the government to look for solutions in general, that would be, I guess, the first point. And secondly, is to share good practice. That is not necessarily a very hard recommendation, but all these promising stories and promising approaches, this best practice which are emerging in the country needs to be somehow aggregated and disseminated so that people build self-confidence and build history. This is, again, a very, very important role of the government.
In this search for solutions, at least from Russian experience, what is important, some government framework to support partnerships with public money. General partnerships between public and private sector at different level of the government in different sectors. If you have this opportunity for partnerships to emerge, then diaspora nicely could feed in some of these allowed arrangements. But in Russia and several other countries in the former Soviet Union, public procurement legislation is so inflexible, so it's very difficult to spend public money on any kind of grant programs, which kind of undermines this idea of public-private partnerships in a big way.
Curiously, that's somewhat true. That's somewhat true in parts of the U.S. government as well, and it has taken, at least in working with diasporas, sort of special units sort of set up on the sidelines of mainstream agencies to do this kind of experimentation and risk taking, which is often very difficult within bureaucracies. So I think that ability to tolerate or even support risk taking is important. The other observation that I'd make here is that is on the role of local government, and particularly in big countries like Russia, like China, you often find that experiments can sort of take place in municipalities and state governments, a little bit, as you were saying earlier, with sort of without anyone noticing, and sort of proceed under the radar screen until they have some good results to show. So local governments in China have been much more innovative in working with diasporas than the central government has, at least until recently. But I'd love to hear from some of those of you who have either not only in countries of origin, but also in sort of destination countries where diasporas have been have established themselves and are sort of building these bridges with countries of origin, what the role of government can be or has been in some cases. Luca, please.
International Organization for Migration. IOM has been given considerable attention to the whole issue of transnational community or diasporas in their potential for home country development. And do you see a role for international cooperation policies to foster this potential? I mean, you've been discussing about individual entrepreneurships and role of governments, if any, to facilitate engagement of the diaspora, but they also see a potential for international cooperation policies to promote that. If so, in what directions, in your view, particularly now that we are approaching the high-level dialogue where we would expect some reflection on these topics and perhaps some policy recommendations?
That made that point, Luca, and as you know, we here at MPI have worked very closely with IOM on this subject. I think there's a particularly important role for international organizations, not only in the usual things you would expect, funding pilot projects and sponsoring research, but also in allowing governments to share their experiences, not just governments, but diaspora groups as well. IOM just had a huge diaspora conference in June, it was remarkable for the enthusiasm. You know, that governments didn't just kind of, you know, the usual suspects sort of turning up, but a very large turnout, over 500 delegates, 50 countries represented at ministerial level, which I think shows the hope that the international organizations will play an active role. And I think IOM and the World Bank have really been leading in that space. We had a comment in the back, please.
I wanted to take up... my name's David Phillips. I've written a book on the diaspora recently, and I was formerly with the World Bank. I just want to take up the whole question about government involvement, and I wanted to cite the case of Somalia, Somaliland, where I'm working at the moment with the bank. This is a very possibly unique case, but possibly not, and a very important case in Africa of a country where foreign aid has hardly existed for the last 20 or 30 years, because of the civil conflicts of the country. And yet there's a very, very large diaspora. There's probably more than $2 billion a year in remittances going in there. I'm working on projects out there where there's been perhaps 2,000 or 3,000 investment proposals, a large chunk of which come from the diaspora, within a country where essentially the business environment is terrible, the regulatory system hardly exists, and there's major infrastructure disruption and still a civil war. So my question is, how do we reconcile this situation whereby there's this tremendous dynamic and tremendous energy within the diaspora and with the investment community, with the the government role. And the question is, as you, Kathleen, you were saying before, there was always a question about whether the government should sort of, quote, get out of the way. I think that, it's extremely important to design policies whereby the government is not in any way crowding out the energy and the initiative of the diaspora, which already exists. And, I believe that international aid should, if you like, have a very light touch, whether and essentially encourage it to use its energy and in many ways, for example, possibly encouraging the government to work more on the business environment regulatory system as essential preconditions, and also work on issues like, for example, U.S. financial regulatory efforts to, say, quell some of the work of the international money transfer companies.
David, for those comments, I think Somalia is a really interesting case.
It's extremely interesting question and probably very open-ended one. What do you do? How do you operate in a country with a bad investment climate and bad institutions? And I think one of the paradoxes of this approach, or rather paradoxes which this approach uncovers and brings to light, is that mining constraints on diaspora engagement is always on the receiving end. Even in the countries which can't be better, if you look at how Global Scott works, which is one of the most interesting diaspora programs, enthusiasm on diaspora always bumps upon constraints in Scotland. So constraints is always on the receiving end. So the question is how to create certain local conditions in countries like Somalia and any countries in Africa. That's where our argument about heterogeneity becomes really central, because your institutions in countries like Somalia can be bad in general, but there are certain institutions which are better than others. There are always exceptions. If there are no exceptions, then the country is an infernal trap. That's meaning that any development stops before it starts. But I would argue that there are very little countries which remain in this level of infernal trap. There is always certain heterogeneity. There are always exceptions, most likely individuals in countries like Somalia, in which you can develop an agenda. That's where the notion of a project which certain results which can be measured and can be scaled up become central. Maybe Lev can offer more observation of that sort of from Armenia.
I'd like to link this with previous comment by Luca. What is the role of international organizations? In my view, the most promising thing, agenda for international organizations, is to look for best practice solution of individual member governments and trying to replicate and disseminate them. Administrative solutions which facilitate movement of skilled labor across the border, basically allowing diaspora people to move around and work flexibly around the world. It's the issues of visas, work permits, recognition of diplomas of all sorts, flexible arrangements for employment, parallel labs for scientists, on different sides of divide. My understanding is that different governments have made different degree of progress with removing these constraints. And there is an agenda to look for good solutions and help others who want them to apply.
Thanks. Yeah, I think just one thing that I would add, and I think Somalia is a good example. Well, I don't know if it's such a good example, but perhaps an example, is that some of these gaps that you mentioned, David, represent opportunities also for the diaspora. And I'm thinking of the tremendous growth in mobile phone networks in Africa, where, you know, the communications infrastructure was really dire, and someone like Mo Ibrahim comes along and you know, creates mobile networks, sort of leapfrogging over a generation or two of technology in a way that that takes advantage of the gap in infrastructure. And I think there are probably some institutional examples of that as well, particularly on diasporas, where a number of governments, particularly more advanced governments, have more governments of more economically advanced countries have relied on non-governmental structures to sort of take the lead on diaspora engagement, perhaps recognizing that that gap in the government structure is something that's better filled by someone else. And I'm thinking of, well, Chile, some of these structures are sort of quasi-governmental, like Fundación Chile or Chile Global, the Ireland Funds, an NGO taking the lead, Global Scot, which has government support, KIA in New Zealand, Advance Australia. I mean, these are examples of the private sector taking the lead on diaspora engagement. But I wonder if you can do that in places where there isn't some institutional strength that they can relate to.
Well, what is emerging as one solution is contests between domestic organizations to engage diaspora in certain areas. Science and ethnology appears to be a particular popular one, because that's, you know, talent. First thing it looks for is the environment of peers. So you have a tremendous immigration in countries like Mexico, Russia, Argentina, India. So simultaneously, although independently from each other, such contests where engineered by science and technology ministries, sometimes in collaboration with foreign ministers like in Mexico, EMEA, and CONACYT, sort of to engage science and technology diaspora in domestic project. Russia has the same scheme, which is now being replicated for the fourth time now, without sort of much analysis of results of the first three. Croatia and Vietnam, which is going to introduce one. So that diversity shows that it sort of appears to be a promising instrument.
Yes, please.
Hello, my name is Yelkai Mudzi, and I'm originally from Zimbabwe. I've got two questions. One relates to, how does reconciliation look in this discussion of engaging the diaspora when you consider a context where people left because of forced situations, like economic reasons, hyperinflation, and then how do you bridge relationships in such a situation so that you can then start investing and that element? And then next, as a young person who left the country as a teenager and has been educated abroad but wants to contribute, there are multiple issues I'm dealing with as a youth. The visa situations in the US and getting visa sponsorship, but then also thinking I can't necessarily just go back home when the degree that I've earned does not necessarily match up with the opportunities or the infrastructure that's on the ground. For example, if you earned a PhD in chemistry and you are using these particular equipment to do research, how do you really bridge the infrastructure on the ground, the opportunities on the ground, with the kind of education you've had?
Question. Thank you very much for...
Yes.
No easy answers here, but some thoughts.
The first part of your question is about building trust between people who left and people who left in the country. And it emerges in every environment. For instance, Chile, in my examples, was the examples of advanced country. But even there, people who left during Pinochet regime is perceived as traitors. And there is no substitute by gradually building this trust in joint projects. That you actually start doing something together. Both people are in the home country, which are not necessarily very friendly initially, who people who left, but goodwill and ability to collaborate, it eventually leads you quite far, as my example in the beginning about Irish process and Good Friday alluded to. Again, there is no kind of magic bullet or easy solution to it. It's a gradual, painstaking process of building trust in doing things together, not talking about them, but actually doing them. But one of the paradoxes which we uncovered in our survey, and frankly we didn't expect, that diaspora people who are engaged in project in the home country has better perception about business environment than those who stay afar and just read about it. In other words, in Russia, people who just hear the news about corruption in the Russian state or Argentina, they have a worse perception than those who actually engaged in transaction, which is counterintuitive because you thought that people who do stuff would encounter more problems, but they apparently also encounter more solutions and individuals to help them to solve these problems. That's why this paradox and this plea to start joint project and see where it takes you. That is sort of a general comment I can offer.
This is again where international organizations could help to support first movers from diaspora to go to the risky environment with some kind of meager type of guarantee or political support for some World Bank IFC project. With respect to your second question, which is a really tough one about return, our standard answer is that agenda for return of skilled migration to many countries is not realistic. What governments should dream of, not return, but brain circulation. All kind of arrangements for partnerships, part-time work, not going there to do research, but going there to do some training, some lecturing, seminars, at least as a first step. Then many people would come for a longer period of time. Be more practical, not too ambitious.
But I think the issue that you were raising is when remaining is not really an option. When, for example, students who completed their degrees are not permitted to stay in the U.S. or Europe, or so on, and that's a question that's a little bit outside of our frame of reference here, though it's an important one. I mean, I think the thing that stays with you regardless of where you are the ties that you have, you know, with an educational institution, with a former employer, and so on. And what we've seen in many of the case studies in this book and in other cases is that people in the right circumstances are able to leverage those ties. So if they have gone back to the country of origin to continue working with mentors, colleagues at the institution where they had their training, trying to get them interested and aware of the opportunities for collaboration in the home country, and sort of trying to build on those ties. I mean, there's some good examples of cases where that has happened, but I think it's a challenging situation than that of people who are remaining in a more developed country who are in more of a position to build ties with their country of origin, but you know, not to give up and on maintaining those ties and trying to draw people in to your area of qualifications is something that can bear fruit. I think. There's a very interesting chapter in this book on diasporas in sort of peace building, and but there again, the situation that you're talking about is a little bit in the middle, you know, where people are not necessarily refugees but have left because the prospects in their country of origin are so unpromising, whether it's for getting a advanced education or building a business or whatever, and that's where those exceptional individuals sort of come into making opportunities out of what,
or maybe the only hope.
Yeah, indeed. There was another. Yes, please.
I'm William Ugo from Kenya Embassy. Mine would be to find out from the editor whether they encountered the issues of diasporas who are very politically divided, and yet they want to contribute to back home, but because of this, there are all manner of issues. Even as the government would want to help them go back and contribute. I don't know whether you encountered such issues. And also, there are those who are really, they have a healthy disdain of the authorities back home because they could have left under different circumstances. And in some instances, it becomes it's sort of a burden to even interact with those people who still believe that things could not have changed for them to be able to make any meaningful contributions back home.
I'll let our two guests think about that for a minute, and just throw in my two cents worth. This is, as you know, a very common situation among diasporas. I mean, we talk about the diaspora as if it were some sort of unified body, but I can't think of many that aren't divided in some way, whether it's ethnically, religiously, politically, regionally, linguistically. You know, these are very diverse groups of people, and I think that there is a discourse in sort of diaspora policy making that where whatever argument always ends with the sentence, but the business environment, the institutional environment, whatever environment in the country of origin has to improve dramatically before diasporas can be effective. And it certainly helps, but it's just not true that everything sort of has to be perfect before diasporas can be effective. And we've heard a number of examples. And I think this really speaks to Yevgeny's emphasis on problem solving, you know, that you don't have to unify the diaspora and get everyone thinking of themselves as one big happy family before they are able to act. And I think the governments of countries of origin can encourage people to sort of direct their energies to the obvious needs in a country. Doesn't mean they're going to. I mean, people have political agendas, and they are, you know, they are maybe more or less sort of legitimate in the framework of the country of origin, but you can't wish them away. I think, you know, the only thing you can do is try to make sure that they're not constrained in a way that turns them into a destructive direction. But no easy answers here.
Two comments. The first is there is when institutions are really problematic and business environment is really bad, some kind of enclave agencies could be useful. It's no coincidence that the diaspora in many African countries first, in certain instances, get involved in the operation of central bank, because central bank is one of such enclaves which you had to set right. And it operates as part of the government, but usually quite autonomously from the government. So no perfect solution here, because enclave agencies can become can bring its own problem. But that could be one avenue. And second, more general comment, that ultimately you are dealing with the phenomenon of entrepreneurship. That's what we are looking for, and that's what we are trying to facilitate. And entrepreneurs are supposed to be accustomed and dealing with disappointment and failure. It's no coincidence that many examples here come from Silicon Valley, where there is a culture of failing. And it's not that you are supposed to fail or you expect failure, but you encounter problems as part of your path, and not trying to complain, but trying to find again institutions or individuals which help you to solve them. That's the whole idea of search networks. You are searching for solutions. You are not searching for a perfect business environment, because that one perhaps where. The cemetery.
I think we have time, perhaps, for one more question. Yes,
maybe
please.
Maybe about politically divided.
Please, we'll come to you.
I still cannot find better examples than my favorite Armenians. This is a diaspora which is extremely efficient, has a reputation of being well organized in this country. Huge charity machine, able to raise funds for good causes at local and the national level. But as soon as they start talking about what to do with Armenia, the home, historical home, all political divisions which they inherited from 19th century, literally, come to life. And people are not able to find any compromises on how, what should be Armenian policy towards Turkey. They cannot agree how Armenian government in Yerevan deal with Turkey, and because they cannot agree about Turkey, they cannot agree about doing business together and many other things related to Armenia.
Sungbo, I work at the IMF and also African immigrant. I would like to know if you were asked to give five pieces of advice to an African leader who go to you and ask you that in a case of Somalia, for example, that they would like to engage the diaspora, what will it be? And on the other side, what will it be if an African institution in the diaspora asks you what they wanted to contribute to the development of their home country, what would be the five key advice you would give them?
That's probably the next book, yes?
I'm not sure I can come up with five, but I certainly can come up with three at the spot. And for about the leader, the first would be try to uncover emerging collaboration between diaspora and the home country, which are already ongoing. This is one of the sort of surprises, at least for us in the project. Usually a lot of going on, but it's not brought to light because people are afraid of vested interest, which may stifle what is emerging. And so the first is uncover and try to make them public so that people see sort of the seeds of success. So the second step of advice, try to encourage this collaboration with some kind of light touch public sector involvement, which Lev and me are alluding for, like contest between domestic organizations, which would give some extra push for collaboration, which is already going on, starting from domestic organization, and a third piece of advice: celebrate success. Well, when you see it's happening, launch a public relations campaign, which makes these stories public.
Maybe on the second one of what Yevgeny said, I would also emphasize some monitoring framework to attach to these pilots. Public sector will be called to finance. What is important to recognize that we'll be dealing with some untested schemes in the new environment. It will be pilots funded by donor, diaspora, public money, and it requires some good monitoring framework and recognition that some of them necessarily will fail, and it's okay.
I have maybe a bit of an unfair advantage in trying to answer this question, because a couple of years ago I tried to develop a roadmap for governments that want to engage their diasporas, and just very briefly I can give you a copy of that. But the elements of that that seemed to me most important were, first of all, setting a goal. You know, why is it that you want to engage your diaspora rather than just this big sort of inchoate idea that it's a good thing? So set a goal, develop knowledge about the diaspora, who they are, where they are, what they want, what they do, you know, how old they are, etc. Thirdly, communicate with them, and it's remarkable how poorly most governments communicate with their diaspora. The most difficult element is building trust with the diaspora. That's an artifact of communication, but requires a lot more than that. Requires good experiences to accumulate, and secondly, to mobilize them in a national project. And by that, I mean really creating opportunities for diaspora to be involved in things that need doing in the country. It comes back to Yevgeny's sort of concept of being very, very practical and solution oriented. So those would be my five. we are a little past our time, and I need to close. I want to thank both Lev and Yevgeny very much for this really stimulating work and stimulating presentation. The discussion is certainly going to go on, as Luca Dall'Olio from IOM mentioned. There is going to be a high-level dialogue on migration and development at the United Nations in the first few days of October. Tomorrow, Wednesday, September 18th at 9:30, we're going to have a sort of global call-in to discuss the high-level dialogue and what to expect, what's likely to happen there, what to expect from it, and you're all welcome to join that. There's a leaflet outside, and it's on our website if you would like to join in that call. Thank you very much, Lev, Yevgeny, and thank you all for coming to the Migration Policy Institute. We look forward to seeing you here another time soon.
For more information on MPI's Migration and Development Program, please visit www.migrationpolicy.org/research/migration_development.